Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
What is it that holds us together? This is a question that even as we celebrate a week of service, as we celebrate Dr. King, I think that was the key question. What is it that draws us together as people? Not our race, not the tribe, not the way we speak English, not what our collective humanity.
Welcome to this special episode of Talking Points. I'm your host, Brian Kelly, and in honor of MLK Day and the 25th anniversary of the Day of Service, we have a very, very special guest today. Not only is she a Nobel Peace Prize winner who helped to bring peace to a country and end a civil war, she's also a dear friend of mine. It is my honor to welcome Lema Bowie to Talking Points. Lema, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Brian. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. You know, we met probably almost 4 or 5 years ago in Ghana through our work with Peace Jam. How do you explain Peace Jam to someone who asks you about it?
Well, I describe Peace Jam most time as the place where you wish there was Peace Jam when you were younger. Peace Jam is that space where young people just come together, get inspired by the lives of phenomenal people, but also take that inspiration, add it to what they already have, their own vision for the world that they find themselves, and they put it out there. For Liberia, people describe Peace Jam as the only space where a lot of young people come together to think positively to transform a country that is in so much turmoil. Peace Jam is the hope for the next generation. Peace Jam is that global mentoring stage, a place where young people get not just to meet Nobel Peace Prize winner, but to meet Brian Kelly, to meet other people who will just inspire them and make them to want to dream. Again, it comes back to everything we said about the world that we find ourselves in. If you look at where we are in our world today, war, poverty, everything, the young people are the ones who are feeling it the most. And Peace Jam is that space that tells them that you, not them, you can transform this space.
Your life story is incredible. So you grew up in Liberia.
Yeah.
And by the way, Mighty Be Our Powers is Lema's book, which if you want hope and inspiration for humanity, I highly recommend. Now, Liberia, for those who don't know, I mean, it's an interesting country. So, you know, there are the local tribes, and then it was also founded by freed American slaves. Is that how you describe Liberia, or is that US-centric view that, of course, we have something to do with everything?
I think that's a US-centric view, and I feel like that's one of the reasons for where we find ourselves as a people, you know, in that state of turmoil, because in 1822, there was the arrival of free slaves from here by a group called the American Colonization Society, who was trying to repatriate free slaves back to Africa. But when the free slaves arrived in 1822, there were indigenous people living there. And it was the indigenous people who gave the free slaves the indigenous welcome. So to start the history of Liberia from 1822 is a disservice to those people who were there, who welcomed people, who gave them their land. And so you have a lot of indigenous Liberians saying, it's time for us to rewrite our history, that it didn't start. And we have a seal, a symbol like the U.S. here, but that seal says the love of liberty brought us here. Liberians are saying in the interest, others are saying, indigenous Liberians are saying, in the interest of reconciliation, it should be the love of liberty met us here and not brought us here because people were there. So you have these contradictions about the history of Liberia.
And so much of Africa was colonized. So pre-Liberia, what was the country? You know, was it ever under a colonization?
We never technically got colonized by any country, but we feel like at the arrival of the free slaves, that was a kind of colonization. Wow. And that's my individual view, because most of those people who came, the history of Liberia is that a lot of what was done to Blacks here on the plantations and in slavery was done to indigenous people. Mm.
So you grew up and civil war broke out. So the foundations of that civil war date back to the founding of the country and the divisions between people?
Yes. After over 100 years of American-Liberian rule, there was a coup d'etat in 1980 where indigenous people took over. And as a way of retaliating for years of subjugation, for years of discrimination, 13 of the most powerful American-Liberian men were put on a pole and publicly executed. So then a lot of those who already had American citizenship came back to the U.S. And then there was this kind of mobilization amongst them. And then in 1989, Charles Taylor, who is a descendant of American-Liberian, came. So it's
he was American educated,
yes,
right?
And it's all this circle of revenge and violence and revenge and violence that has led us to where we are today.
Lema, what was it like growing up in Liberia when you were just a little girl?
Oh, my early childhood memory of Liberia was awesome. I grew up, I tell people, in a community, and I mean a real community. We had maybe 14 of Liberia's 16 tribe. It was a kind of slum, but it was a kind of bubble. So, you know, that contradiction where people think wealth is the bubble, but it was poverty, but bubble. Meaning, as a child, I never saw anyone go hungry because every house had, they would give food to people. So it was just that place where no one really knew what was happening. I grew up seeing my dad stand up for women who were being battered by their husband. One of my earliest memory of success was that at the end of the school year, those days, the school year ended in December, you had to take your report card and go to every house in that bubble and say, I made a pass or I made a fail. So if you pass to the next class, you got like a coin. If you fail, you probably got punished by every parent, but you had to go to every house. So it was really a decent community that I grew up in.
I mean, really, when they say it takes a village to raise a child, I mean, that really seems like it was that sense of love.
Yeah.
So you had a happy childhood, smart, where you wanted to be a doctor growing up.
I wanted
up,
to be a pediatrician, yes.
So all of those plans came basically to a crashing halt. There were pockets of peace, but then it really broke out again in 89.
Yes. Like one day after my high school graduation, exactly 30 years ago, this past December, we slumped straight to war.
So the war breaks out, you can't go to university, and it's really just a matter of survival at that point?
Oh my God, yes. For someone who was socialized to believe in a sense of community, I'm totally confused. I've never had to deal with this. So gradually the anger started to build up in my life. And then you see execution. I grew up to 17, never seeing a dead body because children, it was an abomination for children to see dead person. But then you start to see people being executed and you are really, there is a total disorientation. Is this my community? Mm. Is this the place that taught me that we were civil? I remember the first time someone came from the village and said to my mom that there was summary execution or that children had been taken from entire village and placed into a well and they were all killed. She said, no, this is, no, that is a made up story. It can never happen in my Liberia. And then during the war, one day, she saw this guy picking in the garbage and she stood up and went, there was this wire fence and said, what are you looking for in the garbage? And he said, I'm looking for palm kernels. She said, what are you going to do with the palm kernels? And he said, that's what I'm going to crack open and my kids and I will eat it tonight. She said, we don't have any food. She said, wait for me. So she went inside and brought 5 cups of rice and gave it to him and said, go and eat. She went back and sat down. Like in split second, a pickup truck came with some army men. And they asked this guy, rice in 1990 used to be called gold dust. And so they asked this guy, what do you have in your clothes? And he said, nothing. They searched him, they saw the rice, and said, where did you take it from? My mom is sitting and watching the interaction. this guy apparently is afraid to see her because he knew
they would go after her.
She's watching, and then she stands up to go and say, I give it to him. And she hear gunshot. He's executed. Oh, and so I come back, and she's telling me, I just killed a guy. I couldn't understand what's happening. And she said, I vehemently argue that we were a civilized people. Liberians were not evil. She said, but they just killed. And she was never the same, probably until 92. So this is just to give you a glimpse of how low we came as a people. So I'm totally confused as a 17-year-old child.
I live in.
This is not my world. This is not my socialization. This is not what I was taught. This is not what I know. So everything was strange to me, totally. And so there was this deep-seated hate for anyone carrying gun, regardless of which side of the aisle you fought. I was just raging inside. There were three kinds of anger that I had. One, anger at the fighters, anger at the government, and then anger at God, because I had grown up in a very religious home, and we're taught that every time we prayed, God will answer us. And I prayed and prayed, and he never answered. So I was like, I'm done with God.
So you gave up almost, not faith in humanity, but I mean, I can imagine the hopelessness, the feeling of hopelessness. Now, you also were a refugee at that point. What was it like having to leave your mother country? I know you were in Ghana at the Buduburum refugee camp, which I visited on our Peace Jam trips.
So we fought together on a ship. My dad used to work with government, so we were easy targets. Like, every one of us was sitting ducks.
He worked in the U.S. Embassy?
Yeah, he was working with the Liberian National Security Agency. And then he was like the government liaison with the American government. So he got arrested and he almost got killed. So the guys at the embassy took him in. So he was in hiding in the embassy. We were out. So for months, he thought we were dead. And for months, we thought he was dead. Until someone, by stroke of luck, told us they thought this. But he couldn't come outside because he would have been executed. So when we phoned him, he said, you all can stay because every day we had to look for food. He was guaranteed a plate of rice from the U.S. embassy. We were not guaranteed that. So once we heard that a ship had come and was going to Ghana, we got on the ship. But the initial message was that this ship was going to Freetown. So my dad assumed that we were going to Freetown. We got to the port, and then they said the ship was Ghana bound. There were no telephones. There were no one. So for months, he thought we were in Freetown whilst we were in Ghana. We got to Ghana. There were absolutely no plans for us. We slept at the port for 3 days. I remember media people coming to interview, and basically the first one of my memory was, were you raped during the war? That was the first question. And once I said no, no one's interested in interviewing again because people were looking for sad war stories. We moved to that camp and we slept on the cold floor, unfinished building. I remember the first time my mom made a mattress. It was of straw. For weeks, she was cutting grass and collecting it and drying it and going around begging for bags. And she turned it into a straw mattress. And that night, we were so happy to just snuggle next to her on that straw mattress. But the one thing that I can say was that after everything, with all the trauma she was going through, she kept saying, imagine all of those people that we saw die. We have life. We have hope. So it was just that kind of encouragement that we're picking up the pieces. Gradually, hope started coming. But to go to school, I was like, no, I'm not going to invest in school when one tiny instrument can take all of that away. So I was just on that camp. But again, I was arrested in Liberia. I was there. I wasn't in Ghana. So after a year on a camp, I got on a naval gunboat all by myself and went back to Liberia.
And in Liberia, you started the movement. And I love reading in your book that when you were on the floor of that refugee camp, what was it, 20 years to the day that you were, you know, in essentially rock bottom, that you won the Nobel Peace Prize. And that is a testament that everyone can do something that leads to something bigger. So what was that initial spark that got you to start organizing?
Anger, Brian, anger. So by the time I had my fourth child, it was an abusive relationship. I left. I came back home. And I already knew in the back of my mind that, again, that socialization that I had from childhood was firmly seated somewhere. It informed my value system. So I knew what was good for me in terms of a relationship and what wasn't good for me because I had seen how the community rally around abuse women. So I come back home and I start to volunteer with a trauma healing program, working with ex-child soldiers. And I realized that the entire system, that women were just like the toy of war. And it just increased that anger or brought it back from the wartime because little girls, the people who had come to distribute rice were having orgies with girls just to give them a cup of rice. I remember just crying and crying, that thing just building up and me telling myself, I need to change this. I have to do something. I have to work with women. I have to do something. But it never really sunk in until I met a group of women who had different forms of disability. One person was breastfeeding her child and her breast got cut off during the war. Mm. But this woman was telling me that she was going back to her community to make a change, that women could make a difference. Mm. And I had this cynical look. And then they asked me, were you raped? Did you? And no. I said, so why are you so angry? And I went back home and asked myself, why am I so angry? If these women have hope, who am I? So I said, that was my baptism into the women's movement when those women really challenged me and challenged what I could do with all of that anger. And it was not automatic. It was one day at a time. So when we started, when I started building the movement, I think there was this realization that you can't give what you don't have. I didn't have inner peace. So there was no way that I could work for peace. There was a lot of anger and toxicness about me as I moved around. I had to tell my story. And I was fortunate to find a group of women who listened to me tell my story. They said they thought I would never stop talking. Hmm. I knew that for women to do that kind of work, we needed a space for them. So the first step was to get these women to tell their stories. Hmm. Stories of rape, stories of marriages that failed, stories of children that had died. And once we did that, people were energetic. They were energized and it was like, what can we
anger,
do?
I'm sure there was still anger, but the anger turned to energy.
The whole idea was getting the few women to be of the same mind. You know, if I was to preach to you a bit, the Bible says, can two walk together unless they agree? There has to be an agreement that, yes, we believe in this. Yes, we want to go with it. For me, it was never about the multitude of individuals. I just needed one committed person. I was fortunate to find seven. And that was the beginning of it.
All right, we're going to take a quick break now. I'll see you right after we hear from our sponsors.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome back to Talking Points. Let's jump back into it. This story is way abridged today, but Pray the Devil Back to Hell is the amazing film that Lema starred in and helped make with Abigail Disney. It tells the story in way more detail. So the movement begins to grow. Women realize that they need to band together. You know, one of the pivotal moments in Pray the Devil Back to Hell was when you face Charles Taylor. So the women were all outside, you were striking, and finally he agreed to meet with you. And Charles Taylor is a notorious warlord. He's employing child soldiers to kill people. And you had the opportunity to go face to face with him.
Oh, yeah. There's a moment where you're afraid, and there's a moment where fear just seemed to disappear because you're just a frame of yourself. Mm. But also because I had been a part of this movement and I've sat with women who told stories of their atrocities. And so this was not my fight. I had to put myself in the shoes of all 2,500 of those women. So I was going up there to tell him, this is it. And then they gave me this paper to read to him. And so once they said they were coming up, we were coming up to him very angry. He said, I'll come down. So I read the statement, but then first they had positioned the mic so that my back would be to him. And I turned the entire thing around. I was just on a roll that day. So then after reading the statement, I tell him that we're sick and tired of all of this. And then he agrees to go to the peace talk. This is the first time he made any public kind of intention of going to talk peace. For me, it was not Lima.
The peace workers that you were with, you physically barricaded the room the men were in until a peace accord was reached.
We sealed the hall. No one would come out. There would be no water going in there for them until something was done. A few days later, about 10 days later, we had a peace agreement signed. We went back home, not just sitting down and celebrating. We took that bucket peace agreement, summarized it, called 80 women leaders from across the country. This is the benchmark. This is what you should see happening. If these things do not happen, protest. Protest, because we were not resting and we didn't rest until we had our first post-war elections.
One of the remarkable things about your movement was that you brought together Muslim and Christian women. Would you say that the pivotal moment was like in bringing together the different factions of women?
I think that's the key. Because in the world that we live in today, Brian, it's easy for people to divide us based on what our perceived difference is. You're white, I'm black. You know, you're man, I'm woman. You this and you that. But if you cut Brian as a very handsome, tall, white man, what comes out is a red blood. If you cut me as a black, very demanding, commanding, overpowered,
beautiful,
whatever woman,
stunning,
what comes out? The blood that runs in our veins technically shows our collective humanity. Mm-hmm. What we were looking for with those women was, what is it that holds us together? And I think this is a question that even as we celebrate a week of service, as we celebrate Dr. King, I think that was the key question. What is it that draws us together as people? Not our race, not the tribe, not the way we speak English, not what our collective humanity. That thing that it's the blood, it's the breath. Mm-hmm. Because if you fall today and that breath is taken out of you, that's it. There is no store in New York where breath is sold. And there is no bush medicine in Africa where breath can be given back to you. So if we come to that understanding, and that was where we came as women, the question we ask each other, yes, you're Muslim, yes, you're Christian, yes, you support Taylor, yes, you support Lord, but does the bullet pick and choose? Can the bullet say you're Muslim so I won't hit you and I'm going to hit a Christian? The answer was a resounding no.
So you believe in, I believe in that travel breaks down barriers. I've become a better person from traveling. Do you recommend in general for people, in order to break down the stereotypes that they have, is to, maybe it's not even going to another country, but is it going
engage
in your community?
Yeah. Talk to them, get to know them. You know, I've had so many experiences of just stopping and asking people questions. Why do you do this? Why do they do this? Why is it like this? Why is it like that? And I've had people ask me questions. Even in my own community, there are certain things I don't understand. So I will ask questions and they say, oh, it's because of this. And then you learn. So the more knowledge is power, the more you ask questions, the more you interact, the more you cross over. I gave a speech once and going into other people's spaces and, you know, just crossing over, taking that step. My grandmother forced us as young girls, my sister and I, to go to a farm of an old lady that was called the witch of our community. We went in there, got to know her, and it was never the same again. So that's what we encourage people to do. Mm-hmm. Go into other people's space. Ask if you can't travel. There are places and spaces, you know, we have to. Because where our world is, the reason why we're seeing the rise of leaders that are not responding or that are widening the gap with racism and all of the different things is that people are not taking off time to investigate, to ask questions. And this is supposed to be the civilized world. Mm. But the civilized world looks more like the primitive world because people are not stopping to engage.
I remember a salient point that you had when right after the travel ban and everyone was upset about, you know, refugees, you know, the U.S. not doing enough. But you raised the point, like, what have you all done to help the refugees on your campus or in your community? You know, there are huge problems we can't stop. But in our communities, there are many ways to engage, to help others. And you can start small. So, Lema, you've turned your anger into a positive force, winning the Nobel Peace Prize. What can someone who's listening today, who's angry about Australia burning or these, you know, huge issues impacting our society, what can an everyday person do to start turning that anger into real change?
You know, most times I say about American women that they sit in their living rooms and they're politely angry. Angry about reproductive health issues, angry about, like you rightly said. I think the first step to doing some of these things is literally, for example, Australia is so far away, but just by researching and maybe sharing some stories about the pains of those who are suffering from the wild bushfire, or maybe writing a letter to someone, you know, that's one thing you could do. People who often say, oh my God, our world is so divided and there's so much racism and there's so much hate. What amazes me is how social media has this way of showing good. You know, like, oh, this guy stopped his car and crossed this old person and it makes 1 million views. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be that way. This should be a normal phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
But it shows how our world is upside down, that good is now evil and evil is now good. So when you see one tiny bit of good, whilst it gets a lot of shares, we need to do more of these things to normalize good, to normalize peace, to normalize love. But right now, what is normal is hate. You know, like you walk into a store and you have a smile on your face. Someone look at you and say, what the F are you smiling about? Smile should be a normal thing, yeah. You know. Anger is fluid. It's neither good nor bad. Our expression or what we do with the anger that we carry in us. Every one of us are angry at something in this world. Do something, like just step out of your comfort zone and do something.
One of the other organizations that I personally donate to is the Bowie Peace Foundation Africa. You're doing amazing work, especially for young women in Liberia. Can you just give a quick explanation of your foundation and how you're moving the needle in Liberia?
So education and leadership development for young women. I'm looking to see more lemas with young girls.
The world needs more lemas.
Yeah, I'm looking to see more young girls who are not afraid. I'm raising the next generation of very loud women, young women who are leaving footprints in the sand of time and young women who are not afraid to express themselves. We have a few young men in our program. We're raising that generation of young people who have the character to lead our country. Today, we have almost 600 direct and indirect individuals that we're working with and sending to school. We do a lot of scholarship for them, leadership development, thanks to Brian and many other donors. We just finished our Peace Hub where young people can come and hang out. But also, we're doing 360 degrees in terms of our support. We want to debunk the myth that you find a lot of the writings around that if you pay a girl school fees, you've educated her. We are doing not just school fees. We do healthcare. We do housing. We do legal aid for them if they need it, because we're of the opinion that you cannot just educate if you don't deal with all of the other issues that they're dealing with. Mm. Our program is also very focused on giving back to community. One group that we deal with also is the forgotten group, the Ebola orphans. Billions of dollars went into Liberia when we had the Ebola crisis. Today, no one is looking back at those children-headed households. And we have some of them on our scholarship that we're investing in. I tell people the Bowie Peace Foundation is my new lease on life. Keeps me looking young because I have to compete with those girls in the looking good thing. But it also has given me that hope that I did it once, but these young people will do 10 times more than I've done. But at this point in time, I feel like the young people who have gone through so much, they are the hope for Liberia. And so my time, my energy, the little resources I have is what I'm investing in. The education of young people, leadership development. But recently, we added one more piece to it. Character building. Mm. Because without a decent character, all we'll do is just keep recreating new Charles Taylors and new field leaders for Africa. So basically, that's what we're doing now. So that's the hope for Liberia. And I would say in this public space, Thank you, Brian, because you've been generous, really generous to us. My staff can go to work in comfort because we have a bus that was donated by you. Our building, you supported the building we have. I don't know how to say thank you. You know, but I remember one thing you said to me. I'm going to put you on the spot now. You said, since you started giving, since you started philanthropy, there's so much fulfillment in your life, and your life has taken a turn that you never anticipated. And I can tell you for free, whether you go to church or not, I'm a church girl, that you have so many young people out there, Liberia, Ghana, South Africa, who pray for you as a result of your generosity. And we're looking forward to celebrating your wedding.
Well, Lema, you are giving me the gift of, I've seen firsthand in Liberia, you are saving children's lives. You're not only providing them education and food, but you are shaping a new generation that will change the world, change Liberia. And I will reiterate, since I started giving to Peace Jam and the Bowie Peace Foundation Africa, my life has in many ways taken off in ways that I would never expect. So thank you for doing the real hard work on the ground. For any listeners to donate to the Bowie Peace Foundation Africa, the website is bowiepeaceusa.org, and that's Bowie, G-B-O-W-E-E, peaceusa.org. Lema, thank you so much for sharing your story today. Hopefully it inspires others to start small, be kind, and let that good in the world multiply. I'd love to just end on the story of that fateful morning in 2011 when you found out that you won the Nobel Peace Prize. You tell the story so eloquently. So can you tell us how you found out that you won?
So the night before, I was at Sheryl Sandberg's house. It was the last day of my book tour. And she said, tomorrow is the Nobel announcement and my vote is Lema. And I said, Sheryl, stop it. You know, I personally never imagined that I would win the prize because everything I've done and continue to do has never been for accolades. It's been because there's a problem and we've been taught to serve humanity, especially if you've been blessed. And so I get on a flight, a red eye from San Francisco to New York because I have an event at the church in New York to speak to a group of women. And so I sit next. So I think I'm the only woman in business class. There are all these men in crisp black suits, you know, that the other corporate people. I had taken off my African dress. So I just put on a boo-boo. So I really didn't look anything Nobel at that moment. Got on the flight, the guy next to me, we didn't speak to each other. I covered my head, went to sleep. We landed. And I tried to put on my cell phone and voicemail full, text message full. My sister had surgery the day before. I said, oh my God, don't tell me she's dead. And if you've lost a sibling before, you always worry about the other. So I'm fighting to read, and I see the first text from Abigail Disney. It said, Nobel, Nobel, Nobel. I told you, my friend, that you'll win the Nobel Peace Prize. This guy that I had not spoken to on this read, I turned to him and said, sir, I think I just won the Nobel Peace Prize. And he looked at me like, because honestly, I didn't look anything like it. The guy sitting in front of us turned around, look, and check his phone, looked at me, look again, said, yep, kiddo, you showed it. Oh, and before he could even think, I was hugging him and hugging every other man in that business class of the airplane. But that was how I found out that I had won the prize. Apparently, there's an early morning call. I missed the call because I was on a flight. So I think in the history of the Peace Prize, I'm the only person who never got the call that you are a winner. So I was totally like disoriented when I won the prize.
Well, I can vouch that even a normal red eye, I'm disoriented. I can't imagine waking up to that news. But Lema, on behalf of everyone at The Points Guy, thank you for everything that you do. You've spoke at our TPG, our first ever TPG Awards, and people still talk about it. Our employees who get to go to Peace Jams around the world and who have experienced the joy that you bring to the Peace Jam kids in real life are always blown away. So you have had an indelible impact on The Points Guy as a company, and you are a true hero in my eyes. So keep inspiring millions of people, and we'll keep supporting you. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, listeners. Happy New Year to everyone.
That's it for this episode of Talking Points. If you're not inspired to go out and help someone or even just start spreading a smile, then I don't know what will help you. Huge thanks to our guest, Madam Lema Bowie, 2011 Nobel Peace Prize winner, an all-around amazing person. Thanks also to Sarah Jewell of the Bowie Peace Foundation USA, and to my amazing team, Caroline Chagrin and Margaret Kelly, and my amazing executive assistant, Christy Matsui, who keeps my life in order. You are the best. Thanks, everyone, and safe travels.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.